But do you at all see yourself as having played a rough game and then been a victim of it?
It's an excellent question. There was a 5 o'clock briefing, and the media did stamp it as a 5 o'clock flawless. Regardless of what they were told at the briefing, and the briefing was done by officers that were in Saigon, and they were reading reports and so forth that they got from the field. But those reporters had the option of going out in the field and talking to anybody they chose. I mean, they had a free rein. I mean, there was no effort, official effort, to try to deny information to them. As a matter of fact, what we tried to do is to give them full information and urge them to go out and see for themselves. So it wasn't a closed society that they were having to deal with. But somebody had to be a spokesman, and the people that did the briefing, of course, were not fighting officers. They were reading the reports. And in some cases, I am quite sure that they didn't maybe have the flavor of the situation to the extent that they might have. As you know, this was my third war, and the first war we had very strong censorship, World War II. If you wrote a letter to your wife, some censor read that letter, and if it was a name or a date in that letter, he took a pair of scissors and cut it out. It was strict censorship for two purposes. One was we wanted to not deny anything that would help the enemy and give him better intelligence on our situation. Secondly, they wanted a second purpose of censorship was to keep the American public unified behind the war. And there were atrocities that took place in World War II that were not made known until after the war was over, because the authorities, the president, and the leadership did not want to take any step that would divide the American public from being staunchly in support of war. In the Korean War, there was also censorship. But in neither World War II or Korea did we have TV. TV added another dimension. Mr. Johnson told me before he died, he was an ill man, he was out of office. As a matter of fact, I'd retired then too. He died about a year after I retired. He said he made a mistake in not imposing censorship. Now, I'm not sure, and I don't want to bore you the details, I'm not sure it was practical to impose censorship. If censorship were to be imposed, it had to be imposed by the sovereign power, and that was not us. That was Republic of South Vietnam. They didn't have the capability of implementing censorship. We could have helped them, but it would probably have taken 6 months to set up a system to help them. It's a very complex mechanism. And even if that had been set up, it would have been very easy to short-circuit the system by having a reporter write a story or take some film and put it in the hands of a courier and get on a commercial plane in Tonsonuk outside of Saigon and fly it to Manila or Bangkok or Singapore or Hong Kong and follow it in another sovereign country. So censorship, I think, would have probably been a failure. Yes, I think that there were times when the briefing officers probably, not intentionally, but perhaps gave a false impression. And sometimes a reporter would stand up and said, "I was just there and I saw that action. And you don't have the full information." And he would brief his colleagues on what he saw. It was a wide open situation. And there's no effort to impose to try to deny information. And even if somebody was foolish enough to try to do that, it never would have worked. Have I answered your question or helped you?
Well, do you think that it's sort of inherently a stiff game between the military and the press, and that were a victim of it or one of its successes?
I meant to mention this. Inevitably, there is an adversary relationship, and it probably was. It was not present in World War II because the reporters wore our uniform, and they went into battle with us. But when they went into battle, they didn't have a camera like you see over there in a sound box and three guys carrying it. They went in with a notebook and a pad. No infantry soldier wants a device like that television set following him into battle, because that gives away his position. And people manning an apparatus like that are in a very dangerous position from the front and the rear. I'm not saying they've been hit accidentally, but it's pretty dangerous place. But there was no adversary relationship then, because they were we felt that they were part of us. Likewise in Korea, but there was an adversary relationship that developed in Vietnam, and I'm not sure it could have been avoided.
Thank you.
Please.
Yes, I wanted to take advantage of your offer to answer questions, not about what you spoke to about tonight, but about the war. And in particular, you expressed your concern with international law, and I was wondering if you're familiar with the Russell Tribunal.
The
Russell Tribunal, which was led by Bertrand Russell.
In Stockholm, yes.
Right, and that was investigating the American involvement in Vietnam and if the Geneva conventions and so on were being followed. And they found flagrant and multiple violations of the Geneva conventions, and it was documented on genocide, which is a book by John Paul Sartre. And I was wondering if the military establishment ever took these considerations seriously.
I'm not aware that they did take cognizance of that. I remember when it took place. I think there was a general feeling that this was propaganda. But I'm in no position to pass any particular judgment myself.
That was a general feeling then, that the specific charges were never refuted or investigated?
This I can't say, because I was on the battlefield at the time, and it could. I would suspect that they probably were. They probably were.
Sir.
Oh, please, sir.
Yes, having served in the I Corps with Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, and following the CBS trial and seeing the interview with myself on TV, I found that the news media, CBS in particular, very simplistically thought that we could have gone into, say, the Asha Valley and said, with a chalkboard, and said, with all the North Vietnamese and hardcore VC, and VC, raise your hand so we can count you. And anyone that thought that that was possible, to walk in there with a chalkboard without getting his butt shot off, is kind of crazy and foolish. So to put that to rest, all the intelligence in the world could not have counted what we were up against for numbers, in my estimation, as being a grunt myself in the field. We, as grunts, having fought battles, never knew the size of the troops we were up against, as I'm sure you're well aware of. That's a point. Question being, though, do you believe, had not there been the political atmosphere back here in the States, that the outcome of what we fought for in Vietnam could have been different?
Yes. Let me discuss this, because it is not a simple yes or no matter. Mr. Johnson's first order when we got involved in Vietnam was that he would not broaden the war. That meant that the war could not be broadened geographically. We couldn't go into Laos, we couldn't go into Cambodia. And it was felt in those early days that the Geneva Accords of 1954 and the Geneva Agreement on Laos in 1962, both to be policed by the ICC, the International Control Commission, which consisted of a commission headed by an Indian ambassador, with a Canadian ambassador and a Polish ambassador being a member, and there were quite a number of people, mostly military officers, from all three of those countries that were associated with them, and they were located in Saigon. I think as a country we were somewhat naive at the outset that those two agreements could be policed. It was impossible, and as a matter of fact, the ICC didn't seem to have much motivation in order to police it. As a result, we had an unprecedented open flank to the west of almost 700 miles. Absolutely unprecedented. You can't defend a 700-mile front. All we could do it was lightly outposted with special forces camps. Therefore, the enemy could have attacked any time along that huge front, whether it be no Vietnamese, no Arvin, no Vietnamese military elements, and none of ours. And that happened to a degree in the Tet Offensive. And that meant that strategically I had to keep reserves available in order to react when they crossed the border, because they had full rein across the border and we were not allowed to cross it. And we were able to keep them off balance despite that huge front because of the helicopter, which for the first time was used on the battlefield to move troops, the Cobra as a gunship, and the medical evacuation, the helicopter ambulances. We were therefore confined geographically. Now, the enemy put everything he had into the fight at Tet of 1968, and he got defeated, and I mean seriously defeated. And any Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese generals and politicians have now admitted that. If we had used our air power the way it could have been used, in the way Mr. Nixon did in late 72, if that had been done 4 years earlier, I believe that the enemy would have been brought to the conference table, we could have negotiated from the position of strength, and an agreement could have been arrived at, and that the territory of South Vietnam could be free at this time. However, let me hesitate to say that if that had happened, and I think it could have happened and probably would have happened, we would have to have some military forces in Southeast Asia now to enforce the agreement. I would remind you that we do not have a peace agreement in Korea. We've got an armistice. And to force that armistice, we got 40,000 American troops still in Korea. So if you have an agreement, particularly with the Communist Nation, you've got to have military forces to enforce that agreement.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please, ma'am.
General, I'd like to return to the issue that you were discussing earlier. You've described the financial and psychological burden that you went through and your lawyers went through in prosecuting your claim. You've also discussed how you felt that you might have gotten a 50-50 jury verdict and you ended up settling.
I couldn't hear that now.
I said you said that you thought your chances at winning with the jury was 50-50 and you ended up settling the case.
Yeah.
Do you perhaps find this indicative of the fact that our legal system might not be equipped to handle actions that involve so much historical inquiry and public debate about essentially what were policy issues?
Yes.
And don't you perhaps think that maybe there are other ways than going through the legal system that you could have vindicated what you felt was a
well? I'm so glad.
CBS.
I'm so glad you asked that question. I was hoping you would. I would have asked it myself if you hadn't. You are so right. I made a talk. I wrote an editorial for the op-ed piece of the New York Times, which was published about 10 days in the Sunday Week in Review section of the New York Times, about 10 days after the settlement. I then talked to the National Press Club in Washington. And I have made a similar talk to a number of bar associations. As you have implied, a courtroom is no place to decide history. There's no place to pass judgment on a battlefield. There are very few jurors that have a feeling of this. And they were dealing with complex things that they had no background on, and it was awfully difficult for them to grasp it. Now, the solution that I have come up with, and I feel very strongly about it, but I did not bring it out in my opening remarks intentionally, that I think we need a national news council. The British have it. It works well with them. The state of Minnesota has a state news council. And these councils consist of well-respected journalists, respected for their integrity, that will hear complaints that are given as to reckless media. And before, however, this is the general pattern that's followed, that both sides will agree there'd be no money involved. It'd be a matter of prestige or adherence to principles. But these distinguished journalists would make the judgment, and the two parties would agree in advance that they would accept as final the judgment.